Scientists Exposed radio show, part of the Freedomizer Radio Network. Yes, we trust science. It's just scientists we don't trust. Visit madscientists.exposed for many ways to listen or call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air. Again, that number is 319-527-6208. And now, here's our lead investigator, Suzanne.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Mad Scientists Exposed. And I've just been horrified by one article that I came across yesterday that's, you know, real obscure. You don't see it in the mainstream. I've since searched up a few more. This is from DefenseOne.com. The U.S. military is genetically engineering new life forms to detect enemy subs. And it's got a picture here of what looks like little glow-in-the-dark little microbes. They're called Marinobacter. It says the Pentagon is also looking, I don't know why they start a paragraph with also, the Pentagon is also looking at living camouflage, self-sealing paint, and a variety of other applications of engineered organisms, but the basic science remains a challenge. How do you detect submarines in an expanse as large as the ocean? The U.S. military hopes that common marine microorganisms might be genetically engineered into living tripwires to signal the passage of enemy subs, underwater vessels, or even divers. It's one of many potential military applications for so-called engineered life forms, a field that promises living camouflage that reacts to its surroundings to better avoid detection, I guess like chameleons, new drugs and medicines to help deployed forces survive in harsh conditions. I guess they're going to mellow them right out, huh? And more. But the research is in its very early stages, military officials said. Well, the Naval Research Laboratory, or NRL, is supporting the research. They support a lot of research, including a lot of astronomical research, because both of the jobs that I had were covered by that. Anyway, when I worked in solar astronomy, here's how it would work. You take an abundant sea organism like Marinobacter and change its genetic makeup to react to certain substances left by enemy vessels, divers, or equipment. These could be metals, fuel exhaust, human DNA, or some molecule that's not found naturally in the ocean, but is associated with, say, diesel-powered submarines. The reaction could take the form of an electron loss, which could be detectable to friendly sub-drones. And here's a quote. In an engineered context, we might take the ability of microbes to give up electrons, then use those electrons to talk to something like an autonomous vehicle. Then you can start imagining that you can create an electrical signal when the bacteria encounters some molecule in their environment, NRL researcher Sarah Glavin said at a November event put on by the Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Lab. Glavin believes the research is about a year away, just a year, from providing concrete evidence that she can engineer reactions in abundant marine life forms that could prove useful for the military. Submarine hunting in particular is what we would like it for, she said. That'll be the cover story. The reason we think we can accomplish this is because we have this vast database of info we've collected from growing these natural systems. So after experiments where we look at switching gene potential, gene expression, regulatory networks, we are finding these sensors, said Glavin. Geneticists have already shown that it's possible to manipulate the genes of E. coli bacteria to exhibit all sorts of properties that might be useful for submarine sensing. But in synthetic biology, E. coli are similar to lab mice. In conventional medical research, is that what happened to the lettuce crop? They're abundant, cheap, and easy to work with, but their real-world relevance is limited. So they're going to launch this GMO E. coli into the oceans, huh? As one of the commenters said below, what could go wrong? But what works in E. coli or in lab mice doesn't always work in other organisms, and you just don't find them in the sorts of places you would want to detect submarines. There's currently a $45 million effort across the Army, Navy, and Air Force dubbed the Applied Research for the Advancement of Science and Technology Priorities Program on synthetic biology for, that's a new term, huh? Synthetic biology for military environments, aimed at giving researchers the tools they need to engineer genetic responses into organisms that would be useful for the military. Sounds promising, huh? U.S. Army researchers are focused on getting synthetic organisms out of the lab and into the field. That also means getting useful new reactions out of abundant organisms and finding new nanoscale, 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter in size, techniques to engineer those molecular reactions. We want to move synthetic biology from the laboratory to the field. That's a big thrust of ours, and so there's a lot of tool development in order to do that, said Demetra Stratus-Collum, who leads the biomaterials team at the U.S. Army Research Laboratory. If you want to move a biological bio-based sensor to the field, you try to ruggedize those organisms. You try to protect them. You try to encapsulate them. You try to basically increase their longevity in these harsh environments. So if you had, for example, embedded in a uniform, a sensor that detects a hazard that's a biohazard sensor, and perhaps it also causes more than one color change dependent on the complex input. So there's more than one function, or it would sense and alert you and also decontaminate a material, for example. It's very difficult now to do that with the organisms that have some bio tools in them now, like E. coli. Her near-term focus is using biology to do and accelerate the nanoscience in traditional coatings that exist now. So I guess they're going to, maybe some wetsuits are going to coat in this stuff. The hope is that soldiers will one day be able to produce or print new coatings in the field to conceal equipment in the open. We're looking to build next-generation coatings where we can dovetail into additive manufacturing, essentially 3D printing, and other more point-of-need production technologies. Those could be useful to control and minimize detection of our materials or of our assets, she said. Back to the November JHU event, where U.S. Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson said the United States, and the Navy in particular, is investing heavily in synthetic biology to better compete with China, an emerging synthetic biotechnology powerhouse. Yeah, they just turned out GMO babies, huh? I bet you they're going to GMO some soldiers with some gills in their necks, huh? Anyway, last paragraph here. We've taken a look at this in terms of its implications in terms of the operating environment, biotechnology as a form of sensing, whether that be algae or any number of other organisms. The ability to detect DNA as it's left behind in the water column advances sensors on the beachheads, he said. We recently stood up Task Force Ocean, which is about getting us back into a competitive stance in terms of ocean science. Like we left, huh? Anyway, I had some thoughts on this. Let's see if I can... I left a comment like yesterday. Let's see if I can find it again today. How many have they had? Our newest, but by... Here. So these are my thoughts on it. The logical flaw: why engineer microbes to sniff out diesel subs to transmit to drones to relay the location when you could just engineer drones to sniff out diesel subs and then phone home? I mean, we've been sending robot sniffer drones to multiple planets, asteroids, and moons for decades already. Why do we need this GMO the oceans garbage? The answer is this is a cover story because they've already done it. Why else would they even tell us? It's one of those secret sciences like HARP and chemtrailing, stratospheric injection, and the non-rocket-based space program that has gotten out of control into the public eye. So they got to pretend they're inventing it now. But of course it already exists. This is why plankton eating whales are beaching themselves by the hundreds. And then, you know, I got one, a couple of likes there. Anyway, this really, really bothers me. This is essentially bioengineering the life of the planet. By, you know, plankton are like the bottom of the food chain. Things bigger than plankton eat plankton in the ocean, and we get, you know, whales with their there's certain whales that don't even have teeth. They have these like strainers in their mouths for straining out the big stuff and just eating the plankton. Apparently, the farther down the food chain you eat, the more nutrition you get. That's why whales are so big, because they eat at the source. The only thing beyond the plankton is the sunlight that feeds the plankton. So this really, really bothers me. Now, I've heard rumors that there are algae that will eat the radiation from Fukushima. Maybe we have to re-engineer the ocean because we've killed it with the Fukushima thing. You know, they don't build a nuclear power plant without making sure it's built on a fault. That's I think that's intentional. I've got a bit of a jaded streak in me after, you know, you live long enough and you realize people aren't being stupid, they're being malicious. So, you know, if it's for eating radiation, you know, my feelings toward it are a little more predisposed. You know, I could look a little more kindly at it. But this engineering something to do what you already can do as an excuse, I think it's because they've already done it. You know, we've heard all these things about how much they've reverse engineered from these downed extraterrestrial craft. And one of them is engineered programmable biological life forms, which apparently that's what the grays are. They're not real life forms. They're engineered biological things. So I guess, I don't know, like bacteria assembled into into a walking body. And so there's some other articles here. Let's see what else we can find. U.S. military wants to hunt subs with genetically engineered. This is Business Insider. The last one I just read was DefenseOne.com. Then there's Business Insider. Then there's MilitaryTimes.com. Genetic Literacy Project.org. How DARPA wants to create spies from genetically modified sea life. Maybe they'll have a different spin on it. Because I can't imagine these things, if they mess with it too much, are they going to be edible to the whales, you know? How DARPA wants to create spies from genetically modified sea life. Wow, this is February of last year. This year, 2018. The Defense One was just like a day or two ago. But this is February of this year. So it's taken them that long to catch up on it. Science, Not Ideology, Genetic Literacy Project. The U.S. military wants to enlist fish and other sea life to help it track enemy submarines at sea. Of course, you could just train dolphins, you know, put little sensors on them, and they issue the certain squeak that you want to tell you there's a sub there. But they have to GMO some of these. The Persistent Aquatic Living Sensors Program could also modify existing species to make them better underwater spies, an effort that would face stiff opposition from environmental groups. You bet! The idea is that marine life, everything from bacteria to plankton and corals to fish and mammals, senses and in some way reacts to the presence of nearby ships. To DARPA, those reactions represent valuable data. Why do they have to GMO it if they're already doing it? The program simply plans to observe the natural, unique behaviors of marine organisms in the presence of targets of interest and to process those data to provide an alert. Jared Adams, a DARPA spokesman, told me via email that the me is this David Axe, who's, I guess, an author here. And they also, I guess he writes for Motherboard. I don't know what Motherboard is. Anyway. If the military can develop a system for detecting ocean life's reactions to passing vessels, it could, in theory, monitor all the world's oceans for enemy activity and do so more cheaply and effectively than with purely man-made sensors. I don't know. What are they going to do? Just amplify what these things are? Once we just make bigger ears for listening. Why do we have to GMO them? DARPA proposes to modify some species in order to optimize their senses for detecting man-made objects. The resulting breeds would essentially be genetically modified organisms and could disrupt or even collapse existing ecosystems. Yeah. For now, DARPA is moving forward with its effort to enlist sea life. The agency has announced a meeting in Virginia on March 2nd for interested researchers. I guess you're going to be putting out contracts. Ugh. Let's see. Genetically modified fish, aqua advantage salmon. Can genetically modified, let's see, can plankton be genetically modified to clean up the sea? Oh, come on. I'm clicking on it. This might be the one that for cleaning up Fukushima. TheNakedScientist.com. Taking forever to load. Oh, man. I hate when they do that. They just take forever to load. Okay. Can plankton be genetically modified to clean up the sea of tiny plastic particles in the ocean? Well, last I saw, they're being the plastic is kind of like collecting in one big central swirl spot in the Arctic. Can plankton be genetically modified to consume and clean up the sea? What do you think? Oh, gee, it's not an article. This is a forum. Living oceans, genetically modified salmon, wants to hunt subs, accused DARPA of genetically modifying insects. Ooh. Of course, this isn't the oceans. This is other. We know they're genetically modifying mosquitoes and turning them loose in California and in Africa. Got beached whales too. Scientists, this is strangesounds.org. Scientists accuse DARPA of genetically modifying insects for bioweapons to spread agricultural viruses. You bet. In a scathing report issued this week, and this is October 7th of this year, researchers with the Science Policy Forum have accused the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, of creating a technology ostensibly used to genetically modify crops with insects, but that could be converted into a dangerous and illegal bioweapon to spread agricultural viruses. The current program is being funded by the Pentagon's darling research arm, DARPA, who last year was found to be spending millions on genetic extinction technology that could wipe out entire species. DARPA's new project, dubbed Insect Allies, involves releasing fleets of genetically modified insects into crops, which would infect plants with a special virus that would genetically modify the plant on location. So this isn't just at the seed stage. This is modifying the plant after it's already growing. This sounds like a Monsanto wet dream. Let's just sterilize that organic crop over there, and then it'll have to buy from us, huh? If you think that sounds scary, you're not alone. The lead author of the new Science Policy Forum report, Richard Guy Reeves from the Department of Evolutionary Genetics at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology, PLONE, says the Insect Allies program is a disturbing example of a dualuse, D-U-A-L-U-S-E, research in which DARPA, in addition to helping out farmers, is also working on a potential weapon. Naturally, as is the case with all accusations against DARPA, when they get caught working on some sadistic planet-killing plot, they are denying the accusation, writing them off as mischaracterizations. If it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. The report was published in Science on October 5th and is nothing short of chilling. According to researchers, DARPA aims to disperse infectious genetically modified viruses that have been engineered to edit crop chromosomes directly in the fields. As Gizmodo explains, the technology at the heart of this research could herald an entirely new way of genetically modifying crops. Instead of having to wait for onto the next generation, genetic changes would be imposed upon living organisms, a process known as horizontal genetic alteration. Hence the technology's name, Horizontal Environmental Genetic Alteration Agents, or HEGAAs. The viruses will be delivered using genetically modified insects as a means of overcoming the previous limitations of delivering HEGAAs, HEGAAs. They've got a video here. According to the report, the regulatory, biological, economic, and social implications of dispersing such horizontal environmental genetic alteration agents into ecosystems are profound. Further, this program stipulates that the means of delivery of these viral HEGAAs into the environment should be insect-based dispersion, like maybe mosquitoes onto people, huh? DARPA plans to release swarms of genetically modified insects like leafhoppers, white flies, and aphids that have been altered using CRISPR or other gene editing systems. The swarms would be carrying an infectious virus to crops that are already established as a means of genetically modifying them on the spot. If this sounds like science fiction to you, it should. However, it is most assuredly not fiction, as Gizmodo reports. Insect Allies was announced in November of 2016, and it currently involves research contracts in excess of $27 million. DARPA is funding four teams, not three as claimed in the report, namely the Boyce Thompson Institute, Ohio State University, Pennsylvania State University, and the University of Texas. Austin maintains that all work is conducted inside closed laboratories, greenhouses, and other secured facilities. Well, since the intentional release of killer bees, we don't believe that. And that the insects will have built-in lifespans to limit their spread. DARPA is hoping to see tests done. Is they're going to lifespan these crops, or this is a permanent thing, huh? DARPA is hoping to see tests done in greenhouses in as few as 2 years. So now here we are, 2 years later, with maize being a high priority crop. They've already GMO'd corn to death, so for the high fructose corn syrup. So considering DARPA's history and their Pentagon funding, scientists are expressing justified concern over the development of this technology. The researchers in this report pull no punches when they claim it may be a cover to develop an offensive bioweapon. You bet it is. It is our opinion that the knowledge to be gained from this program appears very, very limited in its capacity to enhance U.S. agriculture or respond to national emergencies, write the authors in the New Policy Forum. Instead, they say the program may be widely perceived as an effort to develop biological agents for hostile purposes and their means of delivery, which, if true, would constitute a breach of the Biological Weapons Convention, BWC. I guess that's some treaty, huh? We must have signed somewhere. I never heard of it. Using insects as a means of distributing the virus is a terrible idea, according to the authors of the report, because it cannot be controlled. The scientists claim that HEGAAs would be far more effective if simply sprayed overhead, like most other delivery systems, for agriculture. Stopping short of calling it a weapon, DARPA actually acknowledged that this technology could be used as a means of national defense, according to the DARPA website. And they have a quote here, "National security can be quickly jeopardized by naturally occurring threats to the crop system, including pathogens, drought, flooding, and frost, but especially by threats introduced by state or non-state anchors. Insect Allies seeks to mitigate the impact of these incursions by applying target therapies to mature plants with effects that are expressed at relevant timescales, namely within a single growing season." Are you scared now? You should be, indeed. When the people who are exempted from most all federal regulations begin modifying swarms of insects to infect crops with viruses, which would genetically modify them on the spot and refer to this as national offense, it may be time to start paying attention. Now, the one thing where I can see that this could be a defense and not an offensive thing, well, it could be both. According to some of these science channels that I've been watching that follow the satellite data, Ice Age Farmer and Adapt 2030, they follow the solar data because we have the onsetting grand solar minimum is going to last a few decades to maybe over 100 years. We're going into a mini ice age, and we're seeing that now with crop failures. This is why Trump reached deals so quickly with both China and Europe, like one day meets handshake and he at the G20 and he's got to deal with China. And I predict that was over farm goods. And it was. It was. You can look it up now as to what it is. Now, he's making all these promises on behalf of American farmers. And, you know, China is essentially at the same latitude we are. So I'm not sure why they would need our help, you know, as soon as the Europeans do. Or maybe China's planning for down the road. I don't know what the deal is. You know, of course, we're a little bit farther south, so we're a little bit, we have a little bit more time before our crops get wiped out by this these ice age stuff. Of course, you know, we're already seeing early winter on the East Coast, but the potato crops were wrecked in Canada and Russia. They lost large portions of their potato crops this year because of the early frost. They got late planting because the spring start late and the fall start early, so they have a really short growing season, and they've had to leave crops in the ground. A lot of their barley and stuff, the wheat in Europe and in Canada has to be left in the ground, and some of our own has to be left in the ground because we are having crop failures due to this this climate stuff. And it's you know, it's not climate warming, it's seesawing, ricocheting, and then freezes. And stuff is freezing, and we're losing stuff. And everybody is well advised to start learning to grow indoors, in your garage, in your basement, whatever it takes. You know, sprouts are easy. And I'm dropping my phone. You still there? You still there? Ah! Anyway, what this could be used for, like kale survives, and lettuce survives a bit easier in frost, but especially kale than some of the other plants. You know, there are cold weather crops and there are warm weather crops, and if you follow the gardening channels, you can learn about these. And they could be planning to, you know, planning for an ice age, and maybe they're planning to inject some of the survival traits for frost into potato crops. That I could see that as a possibility, but I could also see they could, while saving American crops, could intentionally damage foreign crops in order to force the deals like we're getting now from China and Europe. And I'm not saying that we did this already. I think they're lining up their ducks. So they could if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. You know, the ocean thing, though, scares me to death. I don't see a reason for modifying anything in the ocean. It those things swim free. They cannot be contained. And you're interfering with the food chains in the ocean, which we're not a part of. I mean, we do agriculture, and any fish farms that we've got are fenced off and contained. And I don't see just free-floating stuff out in the oceans. And this is just nobody's thinking this through. They're not talking to each other, and it really, really bothers me. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back.
You are listening to Freedomizer Radio, where freedomizers freedomize freedom.
Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
Did you know that every time you swipe your debit card, those behind-the-scenes transaction fees make the big banks even richer? In 2016 alone, these fees added up to $60 billion. Yes, that's billion with a B. Well, what if there was a way to have the convenience of a debit card, but reroute those fees from the banksters to organizations actually doing good in the world? Organizations that protect the environment or feed hungry children? What if your swipes could literally change the world? Well, Groundswell SPC has found a way to do just that. We've designed a Visa debit card program that shares transaction fees with your favorite cause. Groundswell partners with nonprofit organizations that promote the card to their supporters. Their supporters then use the card to power the mission of the nonprofit. It's a win-win-win for everyone, except the big banks, of course. Groundswell is about to launch its first cards into market, and we're inviting you to be part of this movement as an investor in the company. Go to wefunder.com/groundswellcard to learn more. Set up a free WeFunder account and invest in Groundswell today and get your money on mission.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to talk to you about our newest sponsor, Misty's FreedomizerGardens.com. Now, this is a contraption where you can grow food in your apartment, in a small patio, or if you're like me and you absolutely suck at gardening, this makes life a lot easier. It is a vertical tower garden. We can grow over 20 things at once in a small, compacted area. Good health starts with good habits, like eating wholesome foods. And with tower gardens, you can easily grow your own fresh, nutrient-rich food virtually anywhere year-round without soil. So Misty'sGardens.com, have a look at it, check it out, buy it, plant, and like it. Misty'sGardens.com.
Imagine standing barefoot on cushy grass while you use a professional-grade knife to deftly chop fresh vegetables on your organic bamboo cutting board. The team at MyZestiness.com wants to help your family enjoy home cooking like this more often. They do this by offering fun and functional tools that make your time in the kitchen more efficient and enjoyable. MyZestiness.com offers the finest and most interesting kitchen goods and accessories, all backed by their world-class customer service team. Check out their ever-expanding inventory today. Visit MyZestiness.com. That's zesty like spicy, nest like home. MyZestiness.com.
So we're back. I don't know how many of you heard about the recent whale beachings. Fatal whale beachings by the hundreds down in New Zealand. It's pretty heartbreaking. It's still a mystery. 51 more beached whales die. I've got a list of articles here. Oh, these pictures are just horrible. 51 more pilot whales beached themselves and died in New Zealand, raising to nearly 200 the number that have done so over the past week. The New Zealand Department of Conservation has called to Hanson Bay on the Chatham Islands after receiving an alert that 80 to 90 of the mammals had stranded themselves. About half were able to escape back to the sea. One of the 51 beach whales that hadn't yet died when authorities arrived had to be euthanized. Why? Are they getting sunburned? I don't know. There was no likelihood of being able to successfully save the remaining whale. Department of Conservation Operations Manager Dave Carlton said in a statement, it was the most humane thing to do. Authorities who have teamed up with locals to bury the whales on Hanson Bay still don't know why the second group whales beached themselves. Skin and blubber samples have been sent to Massey University to learn more, so they're going to do whale autopsies. Over 80 pilot whales were stranded off the coast of the Chatham Islands in New Zealand November 30th, 2018. The latest incident comes after 145 whales died on New Zealand's Stewart Island on Monday. In the north of the country, a 49-foot-long sperm whale died in Doubtful Bay last week. Large numbers of pilot whales have been stranding for as long as we know. Russell Leeper, a whale researcher at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, told ABC News, I think this is ABC Australia, I don't think it's American ABC, it seems to be a species that is particularly susceptible to these mass strandings of live animals. It's still a bit of a mystery. They've got more pictures. The Department of Conservation, I'm reading abcnews.go.com, so I guess it is American. The Department of Conservation responds to an average of 85 strandings per year, but most involve only a single animal. The largest recorded whale stranding in New Zealand was in 1918, in the Chatham Islands, when nearly 1,000 pilot whales came ashore, according to The Guardian. New Zealand seems to be a place prone to it, Leeper said. They do have a lot of long, sandy beaches, but nevertheless, they do seem to have a lot more of these mass strandings than we'd expect anywhere else. Now, at one point, I thought they had tied these things to sonar weapons testing by the U.S. Navy. So now they're saying this goes back to 1918. Now, whether this is retro writing history, I don't know. Wow, they're showing, there's a picture here with a bunch of whales and rocks and a lot of blood in the water. Now, I don't know why there's blood in the water. It's pretty gruesome to look at. I don't know. Is it the plankton, the genetically modified plankton that they're eating? Is it the sonar weapons? Is it the red algae that's washing around the oceans now with they attribute it to global warming, but I think it has more to do with the UV rays that we're getting from the sun. We're getting more UV rays now that there's no sunspots. We're getting this stuff. It's pretty sad. New Zealand beach whales, why are so many getting stranded? This is BBC 4 days ago. Excuse me, another picture. The pictures are striking. Dozens of whales lie stranded on an idyllic beach in a remote part of New Zealand. The group were found by a walker on Stewart Island earlier this week, and just a few days later, a further 51 pilot whales died after becoming stranded on a beach on the Chatham Islands. While whale strandings are not uncommon, they usually involve just a single animal rather than a whole group. The recent flurry of mass strandings has brought a renewed focus on the mysterious and rare phenomenon. So the same paragraph calls it both not uncommon and rare. They need an editor there. So why does it happen? While the exact reasons remain unclear, experts say many different factors could play a part. Sickness and injury. Quite often animals that turn up on a beach are getting exhausted. They're malnourished, or they haven't eaten because they're ill, or maybe because there's something wrong with their food chain. And maybe they get too weak to keep surfacing to breathe, so they just go lay on a beach and breathe somewhere. Or they haven't eaten because they're ill. Maybe because their food source is ill, says Dr. Simon Ingram, a professor of marine conservation at the University of Plymouth. They can be in the final stages of being ill or die at sea and end up getting washed up on a beach, he adds. But Dr. Ingram says that sickness or injury mainly plays a part when a single animal is found stranded. The trouble is that in a huge number of animals, it's quite likely that some of them are going to be ill anyway, he explains. It's also true that there have been cases where groups of healthy whales have ended up getting stranded. So what could be behind these cases? Well, maybe they're accompanying their sick family member, you know, and lying in the sun for short periods can be healthy. I've discovered that with plant lights. I can take care of skin infections that I get with plant lights. And so, you know, there's the whole vitamin D thing. I don't know what whales are seeking by lying in the sun, but this might be attempts at sunbathing. And it could be that some come up, lie in the sun a while. Maybe they roll back into sea without ever being found, and some of them don't. Or maybe they wait until it's too late, and they're too sick and lay in the sun. I don't know. It's also true there have been cases where groups of healthy whales, what could be behind these cases? Navigational mistakes? I don't think so. Some experts say that certain aspects of the coastline or seabed can disorient whales, especially if they roam outside their usual habitat, which might be if we're getting these wild storms and stuff. Some places like the tip of New Zealand are hotspots for stranding, says Dr. Ingram. Sometimes this is due to geographical features of the coastline. If there's a feature like a peninsula or a headland, then animals, it's spelled with one N and an A-R, peninsular, or headland, then animals that should be in deeper waters may suddenly find themselves in a confusing shallow bay. Shallow water can pose a risk to pilot whales, in particular because of the way in which they navigate and communicate. These animals forage and feed largely by echolocation, like bats, says Dr. Andrew Brownlow, a veterinary pathologist who has undertaken postmortems on stranded pilot whales in Scotland. So they use sound to navigate and communicate and find their way, using echolocation in areas with very shallow silty mud is like trying to walk through a forest on a foggy day, he explains. It's very hard to get your bearings and see clearly. I will never forget the cries of stranded whales. Oh, this is headlines to other articles. A whale recently found had 115 plastic cups in its stomach. And pilot whales get stuck on Iceland fjord twice. This combination of shallow waters and confused, muddled echolocation is a serious danger and may lead to mass strandings. They end up coming into shallow seas and get stranded by the receding tide. So the natural lay of the land is a real risk factor for these animals. said Dr. Bronlow Hayes. But if they're all together, they all get lost at once, following the leader. But if a single whale gets injured or lost, why do they end up beached in such large numbers? Experts say the answer lies in their herd-like behavior. It's a they also have family groups, and they tend to, that was recently shown by the mother whale who carried her dead calf for like a week or two or whatever that happened recently. They care for each other. It's a problem you get with these very social animals to tend to for reasons we have never been clear on and end up following either a sick leader onto the beach or end up getting lost as a group, Dr. Bronlow says. This particular species seems to be very prone to that herd behavior. It means that if one pilot whale encounters a problem, then it can have an impact on the entire group. Dr. Bronlow points to one case in 2015 when around 30 whales became stranded in the Isle of Skye off Scotland's west coast. We think that was because one of the females was having trouble giving birth and was in a lot of distress, he explains. She came into shallow waters, and all the other members of the group followed her onto the beach. Warming waters, another possible cause of stranding, some experts suggest, is warming water temperatures. We've had an unusual week, which we haven't got to the bottom of, and it's fair to say that it's been an entirely unusual year, Dr. Karen Stutkin, a marine mammal scientist based in New Zealand's Massey University, told AFP News Agency after the latest mass stranding. I suspect a lot of that has been driven by the warmer sea surface temperatures that we're seeing at the moment. You know, it might depend which hemisphere they're in. She explained that that's likely affecting where the prey is moving, and has a consequence. We're seeing prey moving and whale species following. I didn't know whales were meat eaters. I guess some of them must eat fish. I thought they ate plankton, which I think isn't that a plant? New Zealand's summer begins on Saturday. The date on this article, on Saturday, November 30th, 2018. I guess they count like the Brits do, where instead of solstice, they call it midwinter. But in the southern hemisphere, that would be midsummer, huh? Yeah, I lost my place. Let's see. New Zealand summer begins on Saturday, that's the summer, and Dr. Stockton warns that there could be more beachings to come. We're just going into stranding season now. This is only the beginning of it, and we're very mindful of the fact that this is a very busy start, she said. While Dr. Stockton says that global warming may be playing a part in the rising sea temperatures, are they really rising? Most experts say it's important not to jump to conclusions about the role of humans in these cases. Right. I think if global warming's happening, it's geological. Pilot whales have probably been stranding in New Zealand since before people lived here, Dr. Ingram says. It's probably not anything to do with what humans have done, unless we're poisoning their food sources. It's a very dynamic ecosystem, and these animals are in, so I would be very cautious in making any connection between these examples and climate change. They've got more articles and more pictures. So this is all pretty sad. I don't think we can help it by poisoning their food source. But I pulled up a search here on what do pilot whales eat. Pull up this Wikipedia article. Because if it's microbes and plankton, pilot whales are cetaceans belonging to the genus Globicephala. The two existing species are the long-finned pilot whale and the short-finned pilot whale. The two are not readily distinguishable at sea, and analysis of the skulls is the best way to distinguish between the species, not their fins, huh? Between the two species, they range nearly worldwide, with long-finned pilot whales living in colder waters and short-finned pilot whales living in tropical and subtropical waters. Pilot whales are among the largest of the oceanic dolphins, exceeded in size only by the killer whale. They and other large members of the dolphin family are known as blackfish, but they're not fish, they're mammals. Pilot whales are primarily squid-eating, but also fish-eating. They're highly social and may remain with their birth pod throughout their lifetime. In other words, their family. Short-finned pilot whales are one of the few mammal species in which females go through menopause and post-reproductive females continue to contribute to their pod. Sure, there's grandmas. Pilot whales are notorious for stranding themselves on beaches, and several theories have been hypothesized to account for this behavior. The conservation status of both species has not been determined, but bycatch and hunting are modern threats to one or both species. Bycatch and hunting, I guess that's industries. I don't know. Okay, so these pilot whales are not eating plankton or microbes. They're eating fish and squids. What are the other ones? The killer whales? What was the one? Is it the humpback whales? What whales eat plankton? Krill. What kind of whales eat krill? Is krill plankton? I don't think so. Whales belong to two main subcategories, toothed and baleen. Whales with teeth prey on fish, squid, and other ocean life. Baleen whales, also called filter feeders, eat a diet largely consisting of krill along with plankton and other tiny marine organisms. It's sort of counterintuitive. Some of the largest life on Earth, including the largest blue whales, subsist on some of the smallest life, like a 2-inch-long krill. What is baleen? Baleen whales are so named because they have a substance called baleen, also referred to as whale bone, in their mouths instead of teeth. Baleen is made of keratin, the same as skin and nails. And in fact, the material resembles your own fingernails. Individual baleen plates are embedded in the whale's upper gums and made of long, flexible hairs held together by connective tissue. Baleen acts like a sieve to filter krill and other food out of the ocean water. How do whales eat with baleen? Three feeding styles exist among baleen whales. Gulp feeders, of which the humpback whale is the best known example, take in huge mouthfuls of water. The whale then closes its mouth and uses its tongue to push the water back out. Krill and other food remain trapped in the whale's mouth and get swallowed whole. Skim feeders, like right whales, swim through krill or plankton-rich areas of water with their mouths open. Food and water flow in, but only water can flow back through the baleen plates. The whale then uses its tongue to direct the krill and other food down its throat. The third type, the bottom-feeding baleen whale, has only one known example, the gray whale. It plows along the bottom of the ocean, its baleen trapping only food from the disturbed mud and water. How much krill do they eat? The whales that feed on krill eat a lot of it. Most consume about 4% of their body weight daily in krill and plankton during a 4 to 6 month summer feeding frenzy before they travel and breed. A single blue whale, for example, eats up to a staggering 8,000 pounds of krill every day for a 4 month period. Baleen whales significantly exceed their necessary food intake during this time to accumulate blubber for warmth after summer. Which whales are baleen? The largest mammal on Earth, the blue whale, is probably the most famous baleen whale. The humpback whale is another well-known example. The various types of right whales, including northern, southern, and pygmy, also eat krill as a dietary staple. The same holds true for the different types of minke whales, M-I-N-K-E, including common dwarf and Antarctic minkes. Finns, zay, bowhead, brides, and umura whales are other whales that rely on krill and baleen feeding for sustenance. Okay, so that's interesting. So there's two kinds of whales. Some have teeth and some have this fingernails in their mouth to strain it through. That's kind of interesting. So it's the bigger whales that are going to be affected by us possibly GMOing the oceans. Whales eat. Why do whales eat strictly plankton? It's not all of them. Okay. So if you want to give a call here, you can call in. It's 319-527-6208, 319-527-6208, and that will then hit 1 if you'd like to join the conversation here. So I should find some more about GMOing the oceans. Let's see. genetically modified food ingredients. Oh, that's Ocean Spray. The long journey of genetically engineered salmon to your table. People really want to eat genetically engineered salmon. U.S. military wants to hunt enemy subs with genetically... This is the UK news on Yahoo. U.S. military wants to hunt enemy subs with genetically engineered sea life, and this is published just yesterday, as opposed to last February. The Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, USS Carl Vinson, the Ticonderoga-class, to photograph, guided missile cruiser, it's just stock footage of Navy ships, U.S. Navy photo by MASS, communications specialist, second class, James R. Evans, released. In an age of great power competition in which adversarial powers are closing the gap in the undersea battle space, the U.S. military is looking to abundant ocean organisms for enhanced defense. Researchers are looking at the potential military applications of genetically modified sea creatures. By modifying the genes of common ocean organisms to trigger a reaction when they come in contact with unnatural substances left behind by submarines, the U.S. military may be able to use marine life to detect and track enemy subs. The U.S. military is supporting research focused on genetically engineered marine life for the purpose of tracking enemy submarines. Research supported by the Naval Research Laboratory indicates that the genetic makeup of a relatively common sea organism could be modified to react in a detectable way to certain non-natural substances such as metal or fuel left behind by passing submarines, Defense One reports. Okay, so they're referencing the article that we've already read. If the reaction involves the loss of an electron, you can create an electrical signal when the bacteria encounters some molecule in their environment. Sarah Glevin, blah, blah, blah. The reasons we think we can accomplish this is because we have this vast database of info we've collected from growing these natural systems. So after experiments, where we look at switching gene potential, gene expression, regulatory networks, we are finding these sensors. Well, it goes on essentially quoting that same article. So it's just another field. I guess it could be used for good or used for ill. I don't know. There's some theories. I don't know how many of you caught the article yesterday or so that, you know, NASA says, well, we can't deny that, and we can't explain all these UFO sightings. And there's, if you follow Stephen Greer or some of the other UFO researchers, they've already learned some of this genetic modifying, using life as a web to detect long distance. And in fact, that it's inherent in life. You almost don't need to genetically modify anything, but it's inherent in life. There's theories that the reasons that UFOs have returned in this modern age, we have carvings and things of them from thousands of years ago. They've been here before, and they came back because they were able to detect from their long distances that we were setting off nuclear bombs in the 40s. And so that's when they came back in earnest to see what we're doing. We're disturbing their life web all the way to where they are. And aside from the possibility of wiping ourselves out, so maybe they're concerned for their sakes. Maybe they're concerned for ours. I don't know. There's so much UFO stuff coming out now, and all this other stuff. Like, I really believe they've already done this, and that's why they're admitting it now. It's kind of like a soft disclosure kind of thing. You know, people just want the government to come out and make an announcement. And what they're doing instead is they're pretending to invent it now because we're on to them. You know, all the chemtrailing, all this stuff, all this climate modification, and there's stuff that they just can't quite affect yet. Some of the sunspots or the lack of the sunspots, the onsetting ice age, you know, they would like to control that. There's some things that are still beyond our control. And, you know, the theory is that the grand solar minimum, called the Maunder minimum in the 1700s, is what caused the French Revolution. And they had a lot of crop failures too, and a lot of people starved. And at the time, I guess that it wasn't deep enough to destroy all their potato crops like it's doing this time. But So expect your potato prices to go up, your French fries to get shorter and all that kind of stuff as they have to switch to more cold resistant forms of potatoes. But, you know, the European nations learned to eat the potato that had just been discovered in the New World. You know, the Irish, the Polish, the English, you know, the Germans, they all started eating potatoes, but the French wanted their baguettes and they were demanding their bread. And when they didn't have it, they blamed the elites. And Marie Antoinette just thought they were stupid and said, let them eat cake. You know, she was being nasty and sarcastic. And so that kind of like kicked things off and she didn't keep her head very long after that. And if you think the French are mad now, you should have seen them back then when they couldn't eat. You know, well, let's try next year. You know, hopefully all the advancements in high-density hydroponic farms will kick into high gear and save most people from starvation, I sure hope. You know, we have all these the hot climate countries are generally poor countries now. They're going to be our saviors as we set up farms there. But I know Elon Musk talks about going to Mars, and his brother Kimball Musk is into high-density hydroponic farming. He can turn out 2 acres of food in just one shipping container that's been retrofitted to grow inside in a protected environment. So I could just see and every city will have parking lots full of these things growing food. local farming and you know that you can do some of this in your own house without a whole setup of pumps and motors and things. There's a thing called Kratky method, Kratky method of hydroponics, and it's pretty easy. You just set the plant with the roots dangling in the water, and as it drinks the water over time, you don't refill it right away. You give the roots a chance to absorb oxygen, and that's how you don't need the pumps. The pumps were to oxygenate the roots, which plant needs in addition to the water and the nutrients. But you can get by without the pumps, and some tests have been done that show the pumps might even slow down the growth. So it depends on the temperature of the room and all that kind of thing. But, you know, there's stuff you can do. You know, I don't know. Maybe you don't want to live on lettuce. There's other things that you can grow hydroponically. There's all kinds of stuff. You know, there's all kinds of plant proteins that you can grow. There's what are they? Sprouts. All kinds of different sprouts that are high in protein and high in nutrients. And a lot of plants, the nutrients are actually denser in the microgreen than in the mature plant. So you can nourish yourself without huge volumes of plates of food. So it's kind of interesting. There are some foods that will leave you hungry, like bread products anyway. So if you switch to something that's more protein-based, particularly if you're prone to putting on pounds and stuff, you can eat less and not be hungry. So I'm going to take one more commercial break here. Hopefully we'll have enough food crops that aren't genetically modified that you can just grow indoors. And I'll be back.
Are you looking for a new place to shop, eat, and save? Are you sick of paying full price? Would you like to save money at the places you enjoy most? Well, here's a popular savings book that is full of coupons catered to your local area. It's called Save Around. This book is full of exclusive discounts to help you save money around your town. Yes, that's Save Around. You will save money at restaurants, department stores, cars, even flowers. When I take my family out, there are 7 of us. The average meal was about $110 to $140. Last time I took them out, and I'm holding a copy of the receipt right here, the check originally was $120. With the Save Around book, our meal cost $82 at a place we go to quite often. Who knew? And there are a few places we found that we are going to check out. View the books in your area before you buy. Go to freedomizerradio.com or barefootislegal.org. Just click on your city, and within a few days, you will be saving money around town with your new Save Around book.
How would you like to make your work more enjoyable, be more creative and relaxed, all while sitting at your desk? That's exactly what my Serenity Rug has done for me. This revolutionary footrest, I can't even call it a footrest, because this thing encourages movement of your feet, which results in more blood flow. While traditional footrests advocate the motionless placement of your feet, I found that I'm unconsciously digging my feet into the long, soft grass strands of the Serenity Rug. It delivers an incredibly relaxing sensation that closely resembles the feeling of an exotic foot massage. If you have ever had a foot massage that made you want to stay there for hours, you know what I'm talking about. If you have not heard about the Serenity Rug, check them out at serenityrug.com and join the exclusive Serenity Rug community and enjoy a feeling of comfort and relaxation that most will never experience. They've sold out before, so I suggest you do your feet a favor and grab one of these. Again, that's serenityrug.com.
Do you want to live a happy and healthy barefoot lifestyle? Join Barefoot is Legal Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time to learn your rights to live a barefoot lifestyle. There are no laws against bare feet in public, and we are here to dispel the myths and empower you to stand up for your rights. Join full-time barefooter and victims legal advocate Nick Pierce on Freedomizer Radio or the Barefoot is Legal radio show Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific, and check out barefootislegal.org.
You are listening to Freedomizer Radio, where freedomizers freedomize freedom.
So I pulled up some articles on algae that eats radioactive waste, Environmental News Service, and this is dated April 16, 2014. A single-cell green algae that can tolerate extreme conditions may soon be widely used to clean up radiation effluents and wastewater from nuclear facilities in an inexpensive and environmentally safe manner. Most organisms are killed by the radioactivity, but the microalgae, Coccomyxa actinobiotis, is extremely radio resistant and strongly accumulates radionuclides. This bacteria can resist a radiation dose of 20,000 grays, GY, about 2,000 times the lethal human dose. The gray is a unit of ionizing radiation dose defined as the absorption of 1 joule of radiation energy by 1 kilogram of matter. By comparison, humans exposed to a fraction of this level of radiation, 5 or more GY, usually die within 14 days. In 1986, the Chernobyl nuclear accident resulted in human exposures up to 16 GY, causing 28 deaths in the first 3 months. Microorganisms, including algae, already are used widely by the nuclear industry to help manage waste byproducts, but they have high operating and equipment costs, require heavy maintenance, and generate large volumes of radioactive waste. The discovery of the new algae, which uses photosynthesis and metabolic processes to take up contaminants, creates a potential to develop cheaper and more environmentally friendly solutions for decontaminating radioactive effluent and wastewater. Scientists in France discovered this bacteria in a cooling pool for spent fuel at a French nuclear facility. After analyzing the properties of this unique species, researchers now foresee new strategies for the bioremediation of radioactive contamination. Inventors Corinne Rivasu, Emmanuel Fari, Elaine Coutte, Ariane Etier have applied for a U.S. patent for this bacteria as a radioactive cleaning agent. Now, first they say they discovered it, and then they say they invented it and that they're going to patent it. If it happened naturally because it found a It mutated and found a food it likes, radiation. I don't see how they can patent it. So this author didn't pay a whole lot of attention. There's a huge difference between discovering and inventing. unless they're inventing a method of deploying this stuff. The potential of this bacteria is being explored by the research team, which includes scientists from Grenoble University, Montpellier University, and Institut La Langevin. I'm sorry for my French. They are collaborating with scientists in the Division of Nuclear Energy in a government agency known as the CEA, the French Alternative Energies and Atomic Energy Commission. In 1 hour, the scientists say this bacteria has proved as effective as conventional physicochemical ion exchangers in purifying radioactive effluents. Excuse me. Using this organism, an efficient real-scale radionuclide biodecontamination process was performed in a nuclear fuel storage pool with an important reduction of waste volume compared to the usual physicochemical processes, the scientists report. This bacteria are photosynthetic and need light to perform photosynthesis and produce their organic matter. Their growth can therefore be controlled by illumination. In order for them to grow at a given place, it is sufficient to illuminate them, the scientists say. In the pool where they were discovered, not invented, they proliferate close to the light sources. When they are placed in the dark for a period of 2 days to 1 month, their growth stops. The CEA and the Institut La Langevin have put together a bioreactor pilot study based on this bacteria to provide a proof of concept which will optimize the bioremediation strategy. The pilot scale treatment unit removes highly radioactive effluents, including carbon-14, uranium-238, and cesium-137. Wow. In London, Dr. David Brown, chief executive with the Institute of Chemical Engineers, said current technologies for the chemically engineered cleaning of nuclear effluents are robust and efficient. However, processes like evaporation, filtration, sorption, I don't know what that is, and ion exchange can be expensive. Work in other, or just turn the stuff loose in the oceans, right, near Fukushima. Eat the radiation as it comes out. As far as I know, it's still spilling out. Work in other industries indicates that decontamination using bioremediation technologies could be equally as efficient, but cheaper and more environmentally friendly. But none is currently operational in highly radioactive environments. Well, why? The researchers in France are breaking new ground by helping us to understand the feasibility of using algae for the highly controlled nuclear decontamination process. It's not so controlled now in Fukushima, he said, including issues such as fouling, poor size, and reuse of this remarkable algae. I don't know what those mean. But this article was dated 2014. Here's another one just a couple months before that, in January of 2014. This is Algae Industry Magazine. Algae mopping up radiation at Fukushima. Oh, there you go. It wasn't mentioned in the other one. A Japanese research group led by Yoshihiro Shirawa of the University, University of Tsukuba, working to decrease radiation pollution at Japan's Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant, has identified 17 microalgae aquatic plants and microalgae that are able to efficiently remove radioactive cesium, iodine, and strontium from the environment. These research findings were published in the Journal of Plant Research. In the nearly 3 years since the huge earthquake, now it's add another 4 years onto that, caused severe damage to the power plant, the volume of radio-polluted water has increased daily because of the continuous injection of cool water and the incurrent of underground water into the still defective reactor. As the plant strains identified are easy to harvest and dry, they could be potentially useful to recover radioactive cesium from a huge volume of radio-polluted water if cesium is dissolved in the water. Notably, in eustigmatophycian, unicellular algae strain, NAK9, was found to be the most efficient in eliminating up to 90% of cesium without any special treatment needed. The researchers suspect the algae is able to do this by accumulating cesium on its cell surface. Potentially, NaK9 could be used to decontaminate highly radio-polluted water stored in Fukushima's nuclear reactor building or to reduce the volume of the radio-polluted water. The researchers noted, however, that further studies are needed on the mass cultivation and efficient coagulation and sedimentation of these algae strains before their findings, so whatever happened after that. Maybe I can look it up. NaK9 algae. Okay, this is brings me back to the same article. Growing spirulina. Accumulation of cesium by aquatic plants. What's the date on this one? Because I want to know if they're using it. 2016, abstract. This is a scientific paper. A huge activity of radioactive matter, including biophilic elements such as cesium, strontium, and iodine, were released into the environment from the Fukushima first nuclear power plant, which was destroyed by the Great East Japan earthquake in 2011. It is indispensable for rehabilitation to decontaminate and collect radionuclides spread on soils and water in the huge area. However, the amount and concentration of these radionuclides released were very small and low in comparison to those activities. Chemical processes sometimes require high energy and high cost for removing such low concentration of radionuclides from the environment. On the other hand, biological processes such as bioremediation and phytoremediation are thought to be useful because plants and algae have an ability to absorb and concentrate such radionuclides into bodies and cells. Cesium is reportedly to be easily absorbed by plants and algae cells via potassium transport systems as an analog of potassium. Not sure what that means. On the basis of such knowledge, this study for screening was performed to find organisms possessing very high ability to accumulate radioactive cesium specifically and also radioactive strontium and iodine. After testing 188 strains of various aquatic plants and algae, several strains were found to show a high ability to accumulate cesium in the cells by the removal of the radioactivity from the medium. I guess that means the water. High cesium accumulating strains are different from strains which have high ability to remove strontium and iodine, suggesting strains are specific to each element. The best strain for cesium accumulation, coded as NAC9, was found to be eustigmatophycin. Microalgae, I'm sorry, huge Latin names, which was a novel genus and species. This chapter focuses on the cesium uptake mechanism by plant and algae cells, the screening process, how to find most effective strains, which are useful for phytoremediation, and the analysis of cesium absorption profiles. Morphological properties of the algae are also described. So maybe, hopefully, the algae that can do this will grow up around these sources of radiation. Aquatic plants, asianscientist.com, that's 2014, radionuclides and algae, buy algae online. Decrease radio pollution, algae trends, that's dated 2014. I want to know if it's still going on. Radionuclides and algae, or did the mad scientists intend to kill the ocean? Science Direct, what's the date on this one? Sometimes you have to open them to see the date. Sometimes it's included in the search results. Let's see. This one is dated. Ooh, this is May of this year, 2018. Potential of higher plants, algae, and cyanobacteria for remediation of radioactivity contaminated waters. And this is Chemosphere, Volume 207, Science Direct. Highlights. Photosynthetic organisms show potential to clean radioactively contaminated water. 8 organisms, biosorbents, selected for a mixture, cesium, strontium, iodine. I can't read them all. I'm sorry. 12 organisms, pH, competing ions, and chemical modification biosorbents, influential factors. Registered to receive personalized recommendations. Abstract. The potential of photosynthetic organisms to remediate radioactivity, contaminated water, was evaluated for scenarios related to nuclear installations and include the following radionuclides. Well, it's a big, long scientific abstract, even longer than the one I just read you. Maybe you're bored by that. But there is research going on. There's this was published September of this year. It's still, I still want to know if it's being applied. It should be. Maybe this is what they want. I don't know. Maybe it would be nice if the military was involved in doing something nice like this instead of just engineering things to detect submarines. Algae aquatic plants, Kashima site, Pickenspan, news.softpedia.com. What's the date on this? 2014. Global searches for microalgae and aquatic plants that can, and this is National Institute of Health.gov. Let's see what the date on this is. This is actually published by the U.S. government, NIH.gov. And this is dated 2014. Oh, global searches for microalgae and aquatic plants that can eliminate radioactive cesium, iodine, and strontium from the radio-polluted aquatic environment, a bioremediation strategy. I want recent stuff. Let them eat waste. The microbes helping to clean up. This is AsianScientist.com 2015. Maybe they're not making news because they're doing their job. That'd be nice. Loading, loading, loading. Keep those pages loading. June 29th, 2015, AsianScientist.com. Let them eat waste. The microbes helping to clean up Fukushima. Dealing with radioactive waste is a tall order, but the solution could lie with very small microorganisms. Asian scientists. Horonobi, Japan. A reindeer chews absent-mindedly. They have reindeer in Japan? On a bale of hay framed against a backdrop of lush rolling hills. Its picture-perfect pastoral Japan science belies a vast project underfoot. 500 meters below, in a dark, sprawling warren of underground labs, scientists are at work on one of the nation's most pressing problems, what to do with its nuclear waste. The challenge is immense. In a country still reeling from the second largest nuclear accident in world history, behind the 1986 Chernobyl accident, I think Fukushima is bigger. I really do. The sinister legacy of nuclear energy could not be more apparent. Not only must the country find a way to clean up 13,000 square kilometers of land in Fukushima Prefecture, an area 18 times the size of Singapore, it must also have y'all seen the pictures of the double-headed conjoined daisies and things like that, right? Just the things that are not growing right in those lands. It must also find long-term storage for some 20,000 tons of nuclear waste. Even now, 4 years after, because this is only 2015, even now, 4 years after a 45-foot tsunami slammed into the Fukushima Daiichi plant, 300 tons of radioactive material leaks into groundwater every day. Fukushima is just part of a global problem. The Chernobyl exclusion zone itself, 2,600 square kilometers, will not be safe for repopulation for another 600 years. In all, the industry has created some 25,000 tons of radioactive material in urgent need of long-term storage. I can't believe they went forward with this industry. It's a tall order, but what if there were a way to clean up contaminated sites, stabilize nuclear waste, and help with long-term storage? Better still, what if the solution is already lurking in Japan's own soil? First, how do nuclear reactors work? The only difference between traditional power plants and nuclear ones is the source of heat. While the former rely on burning coal, nuclear plants rely on splitting matter itself. For this, they need uranium. Silvery white, heavy and highly unwieldy, it's easily split. All it takes is a shower of energetic neutrons. The hitch is that not only is uranium highly radioactive, but the atoms it breaks up into are too. Why don't they just keep breaking it down and breaking it down. Thus, the waste generated by nuclear power stations is a potential blend of radioactive uranium and its byproducts, strontium-90, iodine-131, and cesium-137. Why is radioactive material toxic? Radioactive elements eventually shed their extra neutrons over time, one by one, until they turn into more stable. Well, anyway, microbes to the rescue. This goes on. I'm getting the notice in my headset that I'm running out of time here. So let me just move my way back here. And y'all need to discussing all the topics of the day. And y'all have a great week. And keep up the good hope that this all will be used for good. All this engineering, every science is a two-edged sword. And if it wasn't the military developing bioengineered life forms, I would have more hope. But every science gets turned to weapons, and it's just, oh my gosh. I just worry. I worry. Have a wonderful week.